assessor's exemption. Jonathan, you mentioned necessity.
Well, again, I think the point is that the aspect ratio and so forth, those were examples of the kind of sharpness of image that you would need, or the reason why you need a certain level of quality to make effective use in the classroom. Now, I am sure that there will be some cases where, you know, if you're simply talking about general plot and it's a little less important to have the high quality, but I think there's an awful lot of situations where the high quality is important, or also, as we've heard, where the lack of quality is frankly simply distracting from the ability to really understand what's going on or really pay attention, because we have now, again, things change, and so we're used to seeing high quality images. A lot of us do have, as Fritz has pointed out, we do have, you know, these HD TVs in our basement, and that makes Bruce's clients very happy because his clients make them. And so we've bought them because they told us that they were good to have. And so we're used to high quality images. And so if we then go to a situation where it's blurry, it frankly distracts from the whole impact, and it distracts from the educational message and the use. So I think to some extent, again, in certain cases, the necessity is greater than others, but I would submit that it largely because of what the folks on the other side have done and how they have changed our expectations, that we need that quality across the board, because if we don't have that quality, it just doesn't work in the classroom.
But I still saw there the use of a number of clips that were of older films or VHS, you know, quality films that were being shown in some of these works. So if what you say is true, why were those included in those montages?
Well, first of all, I mean, you know, partly because they're legacy items, and partly also it was pretty distracting. I mean, the first thing that strikes you when you see an old black and white thing is you say, boy, that's kind of fuzzy. I mean, it's distracting. It doesn't have the same impact. You're not focusing as much on what you're supposed to see because it's...
And actually, just before we go too far down the road of thinking about quality as the main determinant in crafting the exemption, there are a number of other factors that we wouldn't want to lose. So what about works that are only available in protected digital formats? What about this question of disk shifting and use of classroom time efficiently, which I think was a major part of the 2006 exemption? So if you did sort of move the exemption so it was primarily about the quality, we would lose a number of other important reasons and actually a lot of uses that are enabled by the 2006 exemption.
But that does not get to the point of what type of how you get that work, whether you need to get that through decryption of the CSS or whether you can get that through some other version.
Yes, you're right.
Okay, then, and maybe one thing I can do, because I'm not sure, there was a small clip shown before getting to the other issue of just showing what is in the record for Professor DeCherney's that we have on the website. They're playing those full clips, at least the one clip of the educational use, not for now leaving aside the student use. I'm going to put that up on the...
This is an excerpt from a lecture that I submitted.
The excerpt from the lecture that is part of your reply comment.
And I will again just remind people that this was submitted as a DVD in DVD quality, and then it was re-encrypted, you know, recopied, and then posted up on the web.
Well,
in quick
keep
time.
Asking questions while it's down.
So obviously, significantly diminished resolution. You can already see, but
okay.
Bill Deli Carpini and myself in the 2009 DMCA exemption rulemaking. I'll be modeling a typical undergraduate lecture. Really, this is a short excerpt from a lecture on computer graphics, or CG, that I use in a History of Hollywood course. More specifically, I'll be discussing the rise of digital characters and the more specific technique of morphing. So with the availability of laser scanning, the computer graphics work of George Lucas's Industrial Light and Magic, ILM, with their Pixar computer, digital characters began to take off in the 1980s. Morphing is really the first step towards digital characters. In 1988, in Willow, Ron Howard's Willow, there's a character who changes a few times throughout the film. In Innerspace, the year before, morphing is used to have characters shrink in size. The film Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade from 1989 had a much more extended morphing sequence in the so-called Donovan's Destruction scene that you're seeing right now. As with many new technologies, the big studios were not the first to exploit computer graphics. The independent production company, Caralco, was really the first company to take chances on using CG on a large scale throughout an entire feature film. In 1990's Total Recall, Caralco used CG in a few stunning scenes, but the use of CG was restricted to scenes that simulated futuristic computer graphics. Terminator 2, at the bottom of the screen, released the following year, used CG on a much more ambitious scale. The film was directed by James Cameron, who had used some CG to create a character in The Abyss from 1998. ILM created the Abyss character, which only took up 900 megabytes on a computer drive, on a hard drive, which indicates, I think, both the lack of complexity of the graphics at the time and also the short amount of screen time that that particular character received. For Terminator 2, ILM created the T-1000 robot. The character was dependent on morphing throughout the film. He also interacted smoothly with his environment and with other characters. Surprisingly, there were only 47 CG shots in the Terminator 2. The production team used a number of tricks to make it look like many more. One technique that you can see in this clip is the use of a man in a silver suit intercut with composite CG shots. See if you can note the man in the silver suit. So there we see a simple CG shot, and here a much, much more complex CG shot. And for Herndon, it's mostly a man in his silver suit.
This is a great
now, there's one more CG shot coming in this clip, but it's interesting to note the economical use of CG for the film that proved to Hollywood that digital characters were a real possibility. After the release of Terminator 2, morphing started to appear everywhere. By 1992, home computer software for morphing was released for the Macintosh. Many feature films, like Lawnmower Man at the bottom right here, started to have scenes of morphing. Then you started to see morphing on television with Babylon 5 above, Reboot in the bottom left-hand corner there, a Saturday morning cartoon. The explosion of CG and digital characters led to the inevitable discussion of digital actors replacing real actors. I want to show you a quick clip from a documentary included on the DVD of Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones. In this clip, George Lucas and his animation team confront this very question.
Right. George, you met Kevin before, I think, but he's the one who's working on the Widowmaker shot?
The Widowmaker. Uh-huh. So you got him brought in.
See? We wanted just to share the love with Kevin here. So Kevin, front and center, please.
All right.
This is called performance.
All right, so this is where Kevin has brought it.
History, the shroud of the dark side. Begun this clone war.
I just wonder about his ears.
Okay. How much they fall? How much they droop at the end? Uh-huh.
I would maybe let him stay up a little bit more.
Come on.
Yeah. It's a little too hang doggish.
Okay.
This Clone War has
Yeah, I think it'll work.
Okay. So are you going to suggest that a camcorder version would have worked in this scene? Where I just remind you that we're talking about Yoda's ears here. It's something important.
Is that a question in general, to witnesses in general?
I think that's a
perfect example of one where a camcorder version would work. Because basically, in terms of quality, you had a bunch of people sitting around looking at a computer screen.
Yeah, what were they talking about, though?
They were talking about what's on the computer screen, but as I've watched the clip, you were stressing the interaction and the decision they had to make about whether to use a real actor versus CGI. I mean, I don't want to oversimplify, but that's my recollection from having looked at the clip, and I think that's a good example of one where I think it would be very hard to maintain that the highest possible quality would be necessary to achieve your pedagogical purpose.
Yeah, actually, I might have agreed until we saw it here at the much lower resolution than the one I had originally submitted. But Yoda's ears are important to the scene, and you couldn't see them at all at a much lower resolution. It's not just the interaction between people, but they're talking about how to create a new form of art, and it's hard to see them talking about that without actually seeing the artwork itself, which is on the screen.
And quality is how important it is for us to consider the varying contexts in which the screening takes place. When you work, as Professor Czerny does, in an environment where with one touch of a button you can lower the lights to the optimal level, right? That's one kind of environment. But if you're working in an urban public school, in a high school, where the blinds are broken, for instance, you can't really darken the room appropriately. It's different showing it on a data projector than it is on a 32-inch monitor to 35 kids in a room where you can't control the light levels. So quality matters differently in different kinds of contexts. And I think one of the things we want to realize is that we don't all experience context in the optimal settings. That's why we have to make, that's why we want image quality to be superior, to account for those differences that are part of different classroom environments.
Well, I guess a point about that. How much should we be taking into consideration? How much can we take into consideration in terms of what is needed for a particular purpose, what the conditions are in the particular school? For instance, I was kind of surprised in your testimony that the schools who want to get access to content that's protected also can disallow access in a media studies program to YouTube, which is would seem to be an important component of the media studies environment. So how, given the variables that may exist in particular school systems, how can that become attributable to the quality that is necessarily provided or the demands that you're going to make of that particular content?
Well, I think educators want to be able to make non-infringing uses of copyrighted materials. To do step number two on this list of critical questions, what techniques are used to attract your attention, you have to be able to look pretty carefully at the screen. You have to be able to pause, and you have to be able to rewind. You have to be able to see a clear image in that context to be able to do a careful visual analysis. We want to do that with students in grade 4, right? In grade 7, in grade 10. Now, the reality of it is internet filtering is used in schools for lots of really good reasons, since 90% of what's on YouTube is DREC, right? And in fact, seeing a YouTube, I think we've clearly established this highly compressed little image doesn't work in a classroom that doesn't have a data projector when you have to use a 32-inch monitor. You can't use image display the same way in those contexts. In those contexts where a 32-inch monitor is a standard in the corner of the room, you've seen it in every high school in America, right? The only presentation format that works is DVD.
Okay, a question about that particular clip and the, now you've made a point about the Yoda's ears. So this is the additional content that was contained only on the DVD. And some question, I guess one thing would be, in terms of the quality that can be captured from alternative means, for instance, the demonstration with the video camera, Is that kind of quality, leaving aside for a second the impediments to making that picture, is that quality something that would be acceptable? And in fact, does that quality perhaps exceed what we were just watching here from that last clip, which is, as you said, degraded quality from what you would have shown?
Yeah, no, I have to say, the MPA has much better interns than they did 3 years ago. This clip looked much better. I still noted a lot of issues that disturbed me about the quality. One is just that they were using a telephoto lens, and there was noticeable distortion, and there just always will be. But there was discoloration. There was a reddish cast to the images. They were still a little muddy and blurred, and you could see bleed through in the lines. But also there was especially because they were showing dark scenes, there was actually a lot of detail that was lost. That wasn't captured by the camcorder. I would still concede that, obviously, every time I show a clip in class, I don't need the absolute highest quality. I think most of the time I do, but I don't know how you would craft that into the exemption. Other than saying only when it's cell phones, when again, I just don't think that is, I think it's just too abstract a standard to introduce.
Well, in terms of the particular piece of evidence that you submitted, then, for that, in terms of the CG, to what extent was any higher quality necessary? It seemed like you mentioned that there were 47 different instances within that movie. You showed three of them, and they were moving by pretty quickly. There was not any particular real focus on any aspect of that. It seemed to me, at least, to be somewhat in passing with a much longer generalized discussion of CG.
So what I was hoping, this is a problem with my lecture. What I was hoping to show was that there were two kinds of images used there that were supposed to look similar. But at a high quality image, you could actually discern them. Actually, with this one, you couldn't. So one were CG images. And we saw, three CG images in that shot. The other was when they had a man in a silver suit who looked like he was supposed to look like he was, a CG image. And if you're looking at it at high quality, you actually can tell the difference. I actually couldn't.
Saw the difference.
You saw the difference here?
Yeah. Okay. I guess that's. I guess let's turn to one other issue that, and maybe this, I'll use my other demonstration now, because we haven't reached any particular further development in understanding of how other alternatives. I gather that from many of the comments that the impediments to capturing from a screen in terms of setting up a camcorder, having all of that set up to capture those clips, although it seems like in many cases it will contain sufficient quality for many of the uses that many educators would want to make, that if there was a way to take away some of those impediments by using actually a computer as opposed to capturing from a camera, a separate camera, the question is, would that be something sufficient? And I'd like to get a reaction. I know Steve saw this in California, but let me just show a short clip. It's getting captured. Technology was just something that I had used for screen captures in the past and tried it prior to the hearings just to see whether it would capture a DVD.
I'll see you all this coming fall in the Big Rock Candy Mountain. Thank you.
boys. Smithies. Or, if not smithies per se, were you otherwise trained in the metallurgic arts before straitened circumstances forced you into life aimless wandering?
Jesus! Can't I count on you people?
Sorry, Everett.
Well, all right. We take off through that bayou.
Wait a minute. Who elected you leader of this?
That's probably good. This was not a pre-selected movie. It happened to just be what was sitting around from Netflix, and I haven't even watched it yet. But I know, and I'm sure all of you could see that there was pixelation issues with that. But the question, I think, is, again, going back to my first question in terms of that first concept of necessity that was at least part of the basis 3 years ago for the exemption, is that how do we categorize for many of the uses that would be required or desired in the academic setting, in how many cases would something of that quality, and particularly if we don't have an answer to whether this is circumvention or not, there may be some issues. I'm looking forward to hearing more on that. To what extent would this be sufficient for many of the purposes that educators desire?
Can I start? Let me start with film professors, and then we can move on.
Yeah.
Or do you not?
Sure.
I think this would be acceptable in a tiny, tiny percentage of uses that media professors would have. It's really so distorted, not so much by the pixelation, but even more by the reduced frame rate, that it has that look like a silent film being played at the wrong speed. I think that's so distracting, it would be hard to talk about other issues beyond that. It's a potentially infringing technology, and I think a likely infringing technology. But I know that's not the issue.
I guess just to address film professors then first and foremost, are film professors not more likely to have the kind of equipment that the motion picture industry is talking about? I mean, having, do not film students film things?
No, I'm a film professor.
I'm sorry.
You're not a witness.
Not a witness, so, okay.
Yeah. No. I mean, anyone is just as likely to have it on Handbrake or DVD Ripper or Mac the Ripper on their computer, I think, as yeah.
But I just going back, is this just so this is not a part of most? I'm asking the question. I just don't know. Is that filming is not part of any aspects of film studies in?
It would depend on the institution. In our institution, we offer film production courses, and so that equipment is available. Many of the people who teach film studies, critical studies, don't have access to that equipment and don't use it and don't know how to use it. I'm actually not sure why that's relevant, but that's right.
If it's a question of who has equipment, and I know that one of our other people said they checked with colleges. Again, I'm the university, the big one that doesn't have a film program. But we do have journalism, but we don't have a film production one. But we're in the process of creating a film studies department, which would only be some of these people that I represent. But the separation of production and the content of film studies happens, I think, in a lot of campuses. The people who are doing film studies and the people who are teaching film who are not in that department are often in the arts and humanities. And you talk about a digital divide out there for the students, there's often a digital divide on campus between the people who are in arts and humanities and the people who have the big money. We have no professors who officially have their own equipment or that would be bought. Our language department has a language media lab. They try their best to help folks out. There's a center for teaching excellence that helps people with the concept of how to do all these things, but a central facility that actually can do this type of capturing for people for classes would be impossible. Too many professors, too many thoughts and ways to do things, and too many possibilities to have one place and one person doing it all for people.
I also wanted to add that
as a writing teacher, or as someone who was in graduate school, about 4 years ago, I took advanced multimedia writing, and you would receive a lower grade if you had pixelated images in a montage. So as a writing teacher, my inclination would be to give a higher grade to someone who had higher quality images, but see, the reverse is, I'm in a dilemma. You're going to place me in a dilemma because I actually should flunk the ones with the higher pixelated images because they did something illegal, potentially. There's going to be this whole regime that develops, like with plagiarism, where I'm going to have a responsibility to evaluate, did this student hack and that student didn't hack? I mean, that's really scary to me.
But wouldn't the higher quality then that is being expected by some professors be necessarily the circumvented?
Yeah.
Technology.
Right.
Okay, so the school itself is imposing the necessity on other students to circumvent in order to get it. I'm hearing a number of different academic institution issues that are actually contributing to some of the problems in terms of having different departments that aren't,
well,
and teachers who are imposing perhaps undue restrictions on students given the law.
But writing teachers care about the quality of writing. I'm just asking you not to go down a road where you say film studies teachers, they need quality, but writing studies teachers, they don't need quality as much. And that student writing, a montage of African-American stereotypes, that person shouldn't really care about quality. It's not that important. But this person over here who's a professor at a university needs quality. I mean, that's just very unjust. I'm just asking you not to do that.
Can I just get some clarification? It's been bothering me for a while since you started talking. It's been a few decades since I went to college. When I went to college, writing had a particular meaning that I don't think is the meaning you are using. Can you explain to me what you're talking about when you talk about writing studies? I don't think you're talking about writing in the conventional way.
I did clarify in my opening statement that I'm defining writing broadly. This is a report put out by the National Council of the Teachers of English, authored by Kathleen Yancey. And basically, writing is, we don't consider alphabetic writing to be our sole domain anymore due to the advent of digital writing. So by writing, I consider a montage to be a composition, a piece of writing. It could have text or not. So I'm defining writing broadly, and this is how people in writing studies see it. So I'm from a humanities. I think I'm the only one here from a humanities discipline, though. But we think that, well, maybe not, but yeah. Do you have any further questions about clarification about how I'm defining writing?
I think I follow that.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I guess just to get a little broader sense of that, Roger, you had a number of different examples dealing with particular instances in legal, and
right.
And I'm certainly familiar with some of these uses in legal institutions.
Before we get to that, can I comment on this naked example specifically?
Sure.
I don't know if you're going to, just very briefly, not addressing the question of quality. I'm actually pretty surprised by this. I had heard from the Palo Alto hearing that this was shown as an example of, hey, what do you think? I, in my office, downloaded a trial copy of Snagit and tried with three different DVD playback technologies to duplicate specifically this, try to get one of the examples from the movie Seven, for instance, to do this. I ended up getting a blank screen on each one of them. There could be technical reasons. It's
hardware acceleration, right. But you right-click and just move the slider down.
I removed it from the playback technology that's embedded in this, the interactual the player that automatically plays with this, but so it could be just a matter of settings with that. But what I'd like to know, or what I'd like to hear once there's been better analysis of it or whatever, is I'd like to raise the issue that once you've changed this hardware acceleration setting, or once you've figured out the right configuration, are we then going to be guaranteed that this is available under new operating systems such as Windows Vista, where they're trying to do a little bit more in terms of locking down the delivery of information on there? And I also had tried it with a higher-end desktop caption software called Adobe Captivate, which should be greater technology. But the difficulty with that is, though I was able to capture actually a lower-resolution version than this, it does not allow me to contemporaneously capture the sound.
I can have the sound coming from a line-in source, so I'd have to figure out a way to snake it around without feedback, or I can have a microphone coming in. So just very briefly, I just wanted to go on record saying, I tried it. You're right, it's probably the settings. Clearly, it can be done with Snagit, but I had difficulty, and I'm not convinced that the DVD playback software or the operating system that it runs on would be guaranteed to allow me to use that as something. So I'd be a little cautious to accept that as the technological alternative to CSS circumvention for the next 3 years, just knowing that there's some tenuous sort of status of this.
But of course, there's no necessity to move to operating systems that restrict what you want to do, so that there is a certain amount of choice that would be involved in some of these things. But some of the questions that I did not buy stock in this company, and I'm not trying to push this. This just happened to be something I use. I'm sure there are many more, that many of them may work in many different ways. And I think in testimony Fred von Lohmann mentioned in California that there was some mention in the 104 report that we had raised questions about whether certain types of technology, and in particular, I think that had to do with music, and the particular technology we were dealing with at the time was Total Recorder, which actually replaced a driver as a consequence in order to do what it's doing. My understanding of some of the capture technologies is that there's no actual driver replacements. It's essentially doing on a software basis what is being done by the video camera, getting the analog output and converting it to a digital file. So my question for you in general, without regard to that particular technology, if there is any thought about that, is do you have any opinions of if this technology was doing it effectively what the video camera is doing, but obviously removing some of the obstacles that I could see some people say would be conveniences or doing this more conveniently, but if this did the same thing that the video camera was doing, would there be any problem with that?
Just to clarify, Rob, I think what you're saying is, but I want to make sure the question is clear. You're saying that if this technology, this software, actually captures the analog signal on its way to the screen, would that be something that you would consider circumvention? Is that what you're saying?
Or the analog output, what is just being portrayed to the eyes, essentially, as it's coming off of the screen?
You've asked questions that we'll be glad to answer after we've analyzed the technology and lined it up against the legal obligations.
And this is not just, I mean, the question didn't specifically have in terms of, I just want to clarify, in terms of raising the Snagit technology, that this isn't specifically about Snagit, but we're trying to get some understanding in general about if there are certain types of capture technology other than a video camera that may be able to alleviate some of the educational concerns. So we will try and ask that. Jonathan?
If I may, and with all due respect, Rob, you know, there is a very surreal quality to this line of questioning, but also to this entire proceeding and a lot of the testimony we just heard. I mean, obviously, and this going back to the point I made in my testimony, you know, either the quality is equivalent or it isn't. Now, it's pretty clear to me that the quality isn't equivalent. But if it is equivalent, then, of course, the DMCA is a waste of time, and all this stuff about a speed bump and all those kinds of things obviously makes no sense. Because if there's all these other alternatives available that really are good enough for the vast majority of uses, you know, then Bruce's poor members will not be able to sustain their technological protection system. But that leads to another question. Okay, let's assume that they're, putting that fundamental paradox aside. I just can't understand, you know, to the extent that we're saying, okay, we're really concerned about normative behavior, and we don't want to encourage circumvention because that would somehow be a bad thing. Again, that's sort of ignoring the fact that we live in this, I think it was Jack Valenti who always talked about, we live in this sea of infringement. So here we have this little island in the sea of infringement where people are trying to do the right thing. And so instead what they're saying is, okay, well, there might be this slippery slope if we allow circumvention. So instead, what we want to do is encourage camcording? I mean, that seems to be the absolutely most bizarre argument that I've heard. And again, it was surreal when Fritz made that argument three years ago, and fortunately, the Copyright Office rejected it at that point. You know, talk about normative behavior. You know, the MPAA has been going around the country getting states to pass laws against camcording, and it included ratcheting up of the federal copyright law to prevent camcording. And so to sort of say, well, what we want to do is somehow encourage camcording and have this wonderful demo. We should put that on YouTube about how you know, especially, you know, hooking up the analog outputs. I mean, why would you want to do that? Why do you want to make this difficult? This is an easy problem. There's an easy solution to the problem. Why are we going through all these convolutions, you know, again, ignoring the fact that all that infringement is going on out there. It's going to go on out there no matter what we do here. And so why either encourage camcording or encourage instructors to break the law? That seems to make no sense. If we want to encourage, you know, good normative behavior, just say, yeah, of course you should circumvent for this purpose. The quality is so much better. It's so much easier and more efficient. Why make things difficult for people? I must say, this is a totally bizarre situation.
Anyone on that side want to respond?
Yeah, I respond briefly. The fundamental point from the technology proprietor's perspective is that you don't want to have the circumvention tool become something that is available and out there as in the legitimate marketplace. Now, we tried to prevent the circumvention tool from being available at all. That failed. But the notion that the tool itself is something that becomes ubiquitous and accepted as part of the legitimate marketplace is something that is a significant threat to the viability of the technology going forward. The use of the camcorder for the limited purpose to make what is stipulated to be a fair use of the image does not threaten the technology. It allows the kind of fair use that has been discussed here, but does not threaten the technology. And the limited, well, we were concerned about the film studies exemption 3 years ago. The limited nature of that exemption and the understanding of the pedagogical needs of the film studies professors was something that we've been able to get our minds around and understand and accept and have found that it has not actually had the kinds of concerns that has not resulted in the kinds of concerns that we might otherwise have. But to expand it exponentially, I think, is the concern, is the viability of the technology.
Can I make a point to that?
And that is what Section 1201 is about. And so this proceeding becomes something that effectively eviscerates the protection that's available under 1201 and that was available, you know, in the development of this technology, it seems to me is not what this proceeding should be about.
Fritz, then Renee.
As I said earlier, convenience simply cannot be the standard of this proceeding. If you make convenience the standard, then there's no more prohibition against circumvention because it's not just educators and film professors that have the ability under our copyright law to engage in fair use or other non-infringing uses. You can, I can, everybody can. So if inconvenience or convenience is the standard, then everybody should be able to circumvent because everybody is entitled under our copyright law to engage in fair uses. So there is no prohibition against circumvention. You basically eliminated, voided the circumvention prohibition.
So make Jonathan very happy.
Yeah, it would make Jonathan very happy.
It's not just about convenience.
And while I have the microphone, Jonathan, responding to Rob's question, even if this utility did nothing more than what a camcorder does. I would point out that under 1201, if it is marketed to avoid, bypass, remove, deactivate, or impair a technological measure, it's still a circumvention device and prohibited by Section 1201.
Well, I think one thing we're trying to get out of you folks is an evaluation, and granted, you're not going to be able to do it overnight, but an evaluation of whether it is in fact is just that, or whether you think it's something that does in fact permit people to engage in uses that don't violate Section 1201, and yeah, in fact is deemed a violation of 1201B. We don't know at this point, maybe you don't know at this point, but that's something we'd be interested in hearing from you.
I just want to make a point in response to Bruce's idea, because he says basically the tool shouldn't be available in the legitimate marketplace. Earlier in his testimony, he said teachers can't be gatekeepers. I've just spent the last 2 years working with K-12 teachers all across the country, working on the Code of Best Practices for Fair Use in Media Literacy Education. And what we found over and over again is teachers want to make lawful, non-infringing uses, and they want to help their students understand their rights and their responsibilities under copyright law. They want to help students make the distinction between the fair use of copyrighted materials and pirating. But in fact, I think we're like on your side, because we actually think that if we enable unlocking CSS for fair use purposes, it provides the perfect teachable moment to help students understand the distinction between fair use and pirating. Right now, we have a situation where teachers and students are ignorant, or they're fed some propaganda, essentially misinforming them about the nature of copyright. If students want to pirate, they don't need to go through all the trouble of going to get the encryption code. There are plenty of technologies readily available for students who want to pirate. But what we have going on right now in American society is an erosion of respect for the law. And we educators are here, right? We're here because we are deeply concerned that without being able to enable students and teachers to make legitimate, non-infringing uses of copyrighted material, erosion of the law will continue. And in fact, we believe that teachers and students both deeply respect copyright owners and respect the rights of owners to make technology so that their materials can't be easily copyrighted. But at the same time we respect that, we also respect the rights that we have under fair use. So we actually think we're kind of on your side here, and that's why we don't really understand. You say you don't mind fair uses, but you think that access to this technology is going to destroy your market. But we think actually quite the opposite, that by helping all Americans understand the distinction between a pirated use and a fair use, it's going to strengthen respect for the law, and it's going to strengthen the future of copyright protection in the United States.
Okay, just a couple more quick questions to get a couple things on the record. One, with Roger, I don't think you ever got back to the question I was going to ask you, which was about for legal and use in legal and medical education, and in particular the legal clips that were shown.
Yes.
To what extent is variance in quality sufficient for pedagogical purposes? And I'm bringing something to this in having used many film clips, mm-hmm, in order to make particular points in class. To what extent is that, and to what extent have you considered, do you consider whether there are alternative means available? Because, for instance, in a couple of the clips that you showed, I know that they're available on Benedict.com, which is a website that I use quite frequently for some resources.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple brief things to say about that. I don't know all the sources available for these different things. When I made them, what I did is we bought the DVDs and we made clips from them. I think that quality is going to be particularly important in the area where the question of law is substantial similarity. So you need to see what does the chair look like that Bruce Willis is sitting in, and you can see kind of the three-dimensional aspects of it and how it appears in context of things. It's also going to be, quality is going to be important in a movie like Seven, where the lighting of that particular scene is really dark, and it's really hard to understand the way that these black and white photographs appear in the backdrop of things. So there are specific examples. I don't know if they're the exceptions or they're sort of the defining rules, but there are specific examples, in my opinion, where quality is of utmost importance for the legal context of particularly these focused issues of substantial similarity and other types of things where it's, you know, the type of use that's involved. So that said, I think that you could still get across some of the points. For instance, one of the clips that I prepared but didn't show was from Anatomy of a Murder. Any copy of that is going to be necessarily sort of grainy based on the fact that it's old and that it's a black and white film. We did get it from the DVD version of it, so we did get the best quality version that we had available, but it's still going to be a little grainy. The purpose of showing that would be more for the subject matter of the material that was there rather than focusing on how particular objects were used. So I think that in that sense, having a clip that was not 100% pristine digital quality might still get the message across.
A question for opponents of the exemption. How, there was some question about limiting the any potential scope of an exemption to the not otherwise available in from other sources. How is one to go about being able to identify that? I mean, in terms of if things are being put up occasionally on various sites like Hulu and others, but it, to what extent would someone have to, if an exemption was limited to, if it wasn't otherwise available, how do we sort of figure out what that universe is?
Well, the reason we suggested that is because you've used that before in the past in the ebook exception. At least twice. It's all other digital edition. All the I'm looking for the exact wording of it here, but it's all existing ebook editions of the work, including digital text editions, contain access control. So this is really the same type of thing.
Obviously there's a certain question of reasonableness here about how far you have to look. There's a lot of examples of that in other exemptions.
You did that in the Dongles exemption when you said it's not reasonably commercially available or something like that. But, you know, when I saw all the examples that we were given here, a lot of them are on DVD. The main digital source is going to be on DVD, protected by CSS. There was some comment that there are some recent television shows and so forth that haven't made it to DVD yet, so there would be other means there. Are they protected? A lot of those are in the clear, so you wouldn't need to circumvent in order to get access to a digital version. But, you know, and Hulu is a source of many current, not just Hulu, but also the various network websites and so forth. I think people that are reasonably savvy to this would know at least the sources that they would look for to try to find whether there's an unencrypted digital version. And I don't think that you couldn't probably take an absolutist position about it, that if somewhere in South Slovenia you could find an unencrypted digital version, then the exemption wouldn't be available. But I think some requirement that you show that in order to make the use you want to make, you have to decrypt, I think it necessarily implies that if there's some reasonably available unencrypted digital version, you can use that.
Should we have a reasonable search requirement with best practices?
that's where we'll end up.
Not to get into that. That's for one question about Blu-ray that came out. A lot of the discussion has been focusing on CSS. There were some discussion in the comments about Blu-ray. I'm just trying to get some sense of to what extent are there works that are available only in Blu-ray format, not available in any other in any other format.
Fritz might actually have better
at the wrong side of the room.
Well, I think you're the one who raised Blu-ray, so that's why I was looking to anyone.
We haven't identified any titles that meet that description, but I'm not saying there couldn't be, but we're not aware of any.
Okay.
Yeah, not to seem unreasonable, but the question was to whether or not the DVD, whether or not the exemption could be restricted only to DVDs. And clearly there are many cases when DVDs are good enough. There are other cases when Blu-ray would be much better and much more effective. There are other cases when someone is teaching a media studies class and uses as teaching a video game and might want to take a clip from a video game. Or some other source. And we wouldn't want to discriminate against people who need even higher quality. There are actually cases when Blu-ray wouldn't be good enough. You know, it's as good as something that's available, but obviously if there's something out of a higher quality, that would be even better. So there's obviously this range of material that's out there. There's a range of quality that's available. And there's also a range of media that's taught in media studies classes.
Well, that points out the slippery slope that you get on when you start talking about the best quality that's available. The best quality available is going to be the computer disc in the digital theater that is much higher quality than even Blu-ray. Does that mean that there should be an exemption in the law to allow Professor DeCherney to enter a theater and make clips from the computer disc in the digital theater? I don't think so. The question is not optimal quality. The question is reasonableness and good enough quality to meet the legitimate pedagogical needs of educators. And I think we've demonstrated quite clearly that camcording meets those needs.
All right, but last time around, whether you think we did it right or wrong, we came to a conclusion that for certain uses, and it was precisely the kinds of uses that Professor DeCherney and his colleagues in film studies, the need that they have, sometimes best quality or in any event, really, really good quality is what you need. And I don't know whether I would say you conceded that, but certainly we at least concluded that he had made a case 3 years ago that he needed to be able to get that kind of quality for his particular needs. So let's assume that nothing's changed with respect to that analysis. I'd be curious to know, hear from both sides, whether, fine, last time around we were only dealing with DVDs protected by CSS, that's what was out there. Now Blu-ray is out there. It's protected by a different kind of access control. I would imagine Mr. DeCherney would say, but I'll give him the opportunity to tell me whether he would say that for his pedagogical needs, when Blu-ray is available, he really needs Blu-ray because that gives him the image in a much better form that for his pedagogical purposes, at least in very many cases, makes it for a much better teaching experience, that one that we could probably all understand at that point. If that's his position, I'd be curious then, and I will give him the opportunity to speak first, I'd be curious then to hear what the folks on this side of the aisle have to say about whether the case has been made for permitting circumvention under those circumstances, because I believe your submissions have said this should be limited to DVDs protected by CSS. So I detect at least a potential difference of views, even if we're sticking essentially to the same exemption that we had 3 years ago, but updating it now to look at the marketplace now. So let's start with you, Mr. DeCherney.
So first of all, I, as far as I remember, the 2006 exemption was not only for DVDs. We're not going down a slippery slope.
Says audiovisual works.
I don't think audiovisual works. Yeah.
Actually, it wasn't. You're right. It was much broader. So
yeah. So I just want to remind you, we're not going off down a slippery slope. We went off the cliff 3 years ago, and
we didn't know where the cliff was or that it was there. But
yeah,
okay.
And I don't mean DVD, Blu-ray, and HD DVD has been around in the market for several years, while the exemption has been around, and as far as I know, it hasn't, you know, destroyed the market for Blu-ray or had a significant impact on it. So I can't imagine that extending it another 3 years would cause a significant change.
Can I just interrupt? Do you know whether there have been instances where film professors, not you certainly, oh no, actually into this, maybe you could, have actually used Blu-ray and circumvented with the access controls on it in order to make clips?
Yeah, actually I haven't. I don't know if it's been done.
Okay. But go on. I just wanted to, I was curious because it came up.
Yes. So I've used Blu-ray in teaching. I actually haven't, but I haven't circumvented in order to do that. I would like to. It would be great. I don't know how to do that.
All right. So
it would have been, yeah.
Let's hear a reaction.
Well, you know, the longer we go on this afternoon and as we proceed through this proceeding, we continue down the slippery slope and we hear more and more uses. You know, 10 minutes ago, Professor DeCherney, or 5 minutes ago, for the first time said he wants to be able to circumvent video games. That has not been said previously in this proceeding. I don't believe it was said at all in 2006. But now we have that on the table. We've had literally hundreds of examples given today and in the proceeding so far about circumvention of CSS on DVD. Every single one of them, as far as I know, was a circumvention of CSS on DVD. That was also the case 3 years ago. The Copyright Office, in its wisdom, didn't see fit to include that limitation. In other words, it didn't conform the exemption to the evidence that was before it then. But I would suggest that the overwhelming majority of the evidence before it now is limited to DVDs protected by CSS. Yes, in theory, there might be some, and we just heard also that, as far as anybody knows, there are no works that exist only in the Blu-ray format that aren't also available, in at least of the commercially released works, that aren't also available in DVD protected by CSS. So our concern here really is to conform the any exemption that you recognize to the scope of the evidence, and I think that's what the statute requires you to do, because you have to find that people are now being impeded in their ability to make non-infringing uses because of the prohibition, or that they are likely to be, more likely than not, in the next 3 years. And I simply don't think the record here would support that finding, even in the case of the film professors, for anything other than DVD on CSS. I think Professor DeCherney is correct. We are, and you're correct, that we are seeking a narrowing of the existing exemption in that regard. We think it should have been narrowed 3 years ago. It wasn't, but we're asking again that you be faithful to the statute and only allow the exemption to the extent that there is evidence in the record that people are now being impeded in their non-infringing uses, or that they are more likely than not to be impeded in the next 3 years.
Hijack your questioning, Rob. So
that's good. If I may just respond to Mr. Carson's reference to our demonstration 3 years ago, and the evidence before you then caused you to conclude that an exemption for media studies professor was justified. And I'd just like to point out that Professor DeCherney is absolutely correct that the competence of the person doing the demo has improved markedly. But aside from that, it is a fact that technology has improved markedly, at least affordable technology has improved markedly in those 3 years. And I think that you need to take another look at the exemption that you allowed 3 years ago to determine if it is still justified in light of today's technology, because there has been a dramatic change.
Two more quick points about that I just want to clarify is with the film clip service, Sandra, that Warner's working on, you said that was hopefully going to go into beta towards the end of this year.
That's a goal.
And that would be initially at the time of the beta anyway. Is this just a Warner Brothers project, or this is a...
It's not a Warner Brothers project, but since I can only speak for Warner Brothers, that's who I was speaking for in talking about our enthusiasm for the project and the work that we've done on it. But it's a goal that's shared by all the studios, and the work is being done under the auspices of the MPAA.
Okay. One clarification just in terms of the permissions. One thing that was raised earlier, and I was kind of surprised by when I came across it, you had mentioned the request in for the Tarzan, the letter that was appended to your reply comments, responsive comments, but there was one before. It seemed like the three letters, film requests and responses, in there began to change in terms of tone. But the first one included a statement that there were in order to give permission, that there were that there were a number of different conditions that had to be satisfied. One that being exception is available only to nonprofit educational institutions. Copy of the motion picture was lawful, purchased or rented. The exception applies only to performances rendered in the course of face-to-face teaching. And then there was that last point that was mentioned about screen actors, that in addition to the above criteria, our lack of objection to your use is conditioned upon your obtaining a permission letter from the person or persons appearing in the clip. You may be able to do this by contacting the Screen Actors Guild and giving the address there. To what extent is it, later on it seemed that this was that Warner Brothers was said that makes no representations, warranties, or indemnities should any claim by any other party be raised. But initially it looked like there was a conditioning of permission on getting a subsequent permission from all the individuals contained on there. And I just wonder why that was necessary. And isn't this imposing sort of additional hurdles on the permissions process that perhaps could be if that could be a solution?
I'm not the author of the letter, but as we were submitting our testimony, we were providing the only examples that had come in. The first letter that you referred to, the criteria that are contained in that letter are intended to inform the requester of the requirements to qualify for the classroom exception. Statement that we, don't necessarily control all the rights associated with the use of the clips is, simply a statement of fact. And
that got better at the end. The first one was our lack of objection to your use is conditioned upon. So it was going beyond that.
I can say that I've had conversations with the people who've drafted the letters, and I understand that our current practice is now not to condition the permission on that point, but rather to simply make the requester aware that there may be others that have claims on the use of the clips, and that we are giving them a waiver of our rights, but they may need to contact others.
Okay, thank you. All right, let's continue on the permissions thing for a moment, and I guess this will be addressed initially to Sandra, but since you can only speak for one company, I don't know whether Rich or Steve might be in a position to give us more general information. So a professor gets in touch with a studio asking for permission to use a clip in the kind of context we've been talking about here. How quickly can one ordinarily anticipate it would take to get a response?
As I noted in our testimony, we very rarely get those requests, and typically we send out a standard letter that basically says, these are the requirements to meet the classroom exception, for instance, and, the letter that you saw that we, waive our rights to the extent they're ours to waive, and, depending on whether the person that sends the letter out is in the office or not, it's usually done within 3 to 5 days at the, on average. But actually, when I went through the records in preparing both this time and then the last time that we testified 3 years ago, most of the letters were actually issued the same day that they came in or the next business day.
Fritz, any idea whether the practice at other studios is any different? No. Okay.
Trying.
All right. Let's assume, and it's not necessarily a solid assumption, but let's assume that if you were to write to a studio asking for permission to use clips that you identify in your classroom, within 3 to 5 days you'd get a response. Is that an insuperable obstacle for you? How big a deal would it be if you had to do that, any of you?
It'd be a huge obstacle for me, because in the course of a single day-long staff development program, say, for instance, like the one I did in January for teachers in North Carolina, in a single day, I might use 30 clips. So that would be 30 letters, and that would be 30 paperwork filing and organizing. So for me, that would be a big burden because I'm multitasking already while I'm teaching college and teaching K-12 teachers and consulting. So for me, it would be a substantial burden. I think for K-12 teachers, the burden is more substantial. What they tell me when they've explored that option or modeled that option with their students is that just finding where to write, just finding the right address and the right contact person, just getting the name of the person to write to is a challenge.
Peter, how about you?
I mean, I would agree with that. Finding and figuring out who to ask permission is a significant issue. I'm sure everyone's seen films in which there's title after title of production company.
But there aren't that many studios around, so after four or five times, you'll probably figure out who they all are. So once you've done that homework.
Actually, it's probably not true. If you looked at media studies generally, the major studios, the films they produced probably make up a very tiny percentage of the films that are actually taught at universities and at colleges. So yeah, it's hundreds, probably thousands of studios and production companies you have to write to, and descendants of rights holders and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And you also a lot of the movies that people want to make use of are foreign. Mm-hmm. So you have that, and they're still, even though they're foreign, they still have the U.S. copyright, and so there's that whole added layer. But and we need to remember that again, the statute says, you know, is this going to adversely affect fair use, I've got to say, or a lawful use. And so if the status quo before and status quo ante DMCA was that you just used it, then having to write even a single letter is a, I think, by definition, adverse effect.
I understand that point. I certainly understand that.
But we're just saying, you know, it's multiplied, again, using the word exponentially, it's multiplied exponentially when we're talking about all these companies and layers of production companies and the international dimension, which is a very important part of what we're talking about.
I'd suggest that if you're working in the United States and seeking to use a film in the United States, somebody has the rights to that film in the United States, and it, you know, typically appears with a logo at the beginning of the film, and you could contact that studio, and they you typically do not have to contact five layers of production companies. One studio owns the rights for the territory in which you're seeking to use it.
all right, so I agree with what's been said before. It is a difficult proposition. Just one answer to the question there. A lot of us have to do this other layer of things, which has some connection here, which is the performances of media for groups and classes and festivals on campus. And we do use the traditional swank and all of those guys to find the appropriate rights. But time after time after time, for various festivals, international film festivals and things like that, we end up with holes, people we just can't find the rights for, or we talk to swank, they don't know the rights for, or we talk to experts at Kino or New Yorker before they died or something like that. We go direct to various sources who are in the film industry, and they're often the best film for the best purpose. Often is not, there's nobody to find the rights from. Or we'll find the company that is the last rights holder, and we send a letter, and we may or may not ever get a response back because we can't find the key person for that. So we always have to have five and six backups for everything, for every festival, just in case we can't find the rights holder for the best one. And it happens more frequently for the important, serious films that we need than the ones you're going to go down to your local video place and rent. So, and the fact is, and I have on my flash drive the list of all those classes, and I don't want to drop because you asked one question earlier and then we didn't get to it, which was the non-film studies people. There's those people who are non-film studies people and are not used to having to negotiate rights or to find clips. You know, they do pictures and stuff for their books and their research and all that, and it's a similar process in a way. But true teaching and a lot of those things is so serendipitous that no matter how much planning they do, in a week or in a two-week period, there's always going to be something else that would have been great to be able to add based on discussion or something like that. And we're not, I don't think any of those people are set up to constantly be looking for rights, getting the rights week after week after week, just in case. And if I did it with all the companies, all the classes that I have on my flash drive that I just wanted to show in this example, then each class would probably have someone getting, as you said, let's say 10 to 12 clips a week for a semester for the 100 classes that I have here. And none of them are film people. But they're all visual culture people.
Yeah, I'm not in the rights branding business, but just in looking at, and again, looking at the examples that were provided by the people who submitted comments in the proceeding, there are clearly a number of instances where the time, a 3 to 5 day turnaround, wouldn't be an issue. I mean, there was a group from New Mexico who filed where they were preparing commercial, but within the academic context, materials that were used over and over and over and over again, and that they were providing to people. This is something they were doing long in advance of the actual use of the work. And so I think, again, part of my point is that there may be a number of different solutions to the issue that need to be, people need to be told to use those solutions that fit their circumstance. And only if they don't, then you get down to the question of is it necessary to authorize circumvention? And again, I think the presentation of the camcording probably, from my standpoint, says even at the end where you can't get the permission or whatever, there is another alternative.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, Bruce, at least you're suggesting that there'll be many, many cases where you should have to get permission. There may be some cases where, because of the circumstances, you just don't have the time and you should be excused from that. If that's the case, how do we write that into an exemption? Are we going to have a four-factor test or something? I mean, it gets to the point where it just becomes impossible to administer, impossible to write an exemption that's not seven paragraphs long.
If I can weigh in, at least I'm not suggesting that a first step to every use would be seeking permission of the copyright owner. I think there are uses, such as Fritz's example with the camcorder, which you're not circumventing. It's a perfectly usable clip. It can be used to illustrate many of the points that were talked about here. It can be used and edited with other clips together. And for that sort of use where you're not circumventing, and if you're making a fair use and you're, relying on your fair use analysis that your, school has done, why contact us?
Okay. Steve.
Just to point out, we did provide on page 30 of our submission a proposed revised exemption. If you determine that the film professors have made their case this time, given the technological advances that Fritz was talking about and the improved quality of the camcorded version. So it's not seven paragraphs long. It is a little bit longer than the existing one, but not much. So that would be our proposal, at least as a starting point.
Yeah, and I think that what I was trying to say was fitting in with what Steve was saying earlier in terms of the reasonableness of under the particular circumstances. And again, that's not an unusual kind of legal standard.
Right. Can I respond as well?
Yeah, please.
First of all, I just reiterate Carlton's point about the spontaneity of teaching and the importance of having to reshape lectures even, and especially discussion material, a day or the same day as the class. It happens all the time. Even courses I've been teaching for years, the day I give the lecture, I change it. I would also just remind you that students are also on the table. And so we think about a permission system. We want to think about the impact that would have on students if there was an exemption created for students as well, who were doing coursework, often without much lead time, whether or not they would be able to make use of an exemption. And finally, I don't take this question of censorship too lightly. Mrs. Stairs was very interesting that she brought up the analogy of documentary filmmakers. And I think it's a good analogy. Documentary filmmakers are often engaged in educational projects, and they're often turned down for the use of clips for all kinds of films. I'll give you two quickly. A film about Enron, or actually anyone who's ever wanted to use a clip from The Simpsons. They always get two letters, one from Matt Groening, which is absolutely use it, one from Fox, which says Matt Groening doesn't own the copyright, you absolutely cannot use it. I had students to make this incredible film about Philadelphia and its the curse on its sports teams, which existed until this year. And they asked ESPN for the right to use the material in their film. And ESPN actually wrote that if, since it wasn't historical and they couldn't prove their theory, they refused the use of ESPN material. So this is an analogy, and this is one of the few that we have, a place where there's educational licensing, true censorship really exists.
I just want to add again, to try to inject a level of reality here. You know, we're talking about big decentralized institutions with, how many faculty members do you have at the University of Maryland? I mean, you must have
2,000
just at that one campus. A lot of them are using this kind of content, and more want to use this kind of content. And to come up with this, again, it might shock people on the other side. They're not all lawyers. I mean, they're teachers. They might have PhDs, most of them, but they're not lawyers, and they don't understand all the nuances of copyright law, let alone, the para-copyright of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So to try to have a workable solution that's practical on a big campus with lots of different people who are making a lot of spontaneous decisions, and to have, not only two sets of rules, which is one set for the film studies, whatever that is, okay, given that we have no idea what that means, especially on the Maryland campus where there isn't even a department. One set of rules for them and another set of rules for everyone else. But now we're talking about all these other layers of complexity, of nuance, of trying to say, well, did you search enough websites to see if it was available somewhere else? Is the kind of use you want to make of sufficient quality? I mean, come on, what's going to happen? Given the availability, the easy availability of DSIS, and that, let's try to be realistic. Let's come up with a rule that everyone can live with instead of sort of doing all this legal jujitsu and end up in a situation that we know is not workable. I mean, we want to comply with the law. So instead of, make the law workable, make an exemption that is usable as opposed to coming up with all these contortions that will mean that inevitably you're just, pushing people into illegal conduct. Because the bottom line is they are going to use this content in their classes. That is going to happen, with an absolute certainty. So why not make it work as opposed to make it difficult? There's this unreality to this whole discussion.
I think the equal unreality is that we're suggesting that the solution to a legal problem presented is to push people to use an illegal circumvention tool. We should somehow legitimize that here, and I think that's the concern that underlies all of our testimony
here, particularly
when it comes to next generation formats like BD.
We're here to get an exemption. We want to do it legally, but if you're basically giving us two choices: either do it illegally or to camcord. I mean, those are as a practical matter, those are the choices that you're giving us. And, we've said we don't think the quality of the camcording is good enough. But again, even if it were, hypothetically, why is that a desirable result?
But the Copyright Office doesn't have the power to grant an exemption to the delivery and marketing of those tools.
Oh, but that, of course, that highlights a bigger problem, which we've talked about before, how arguably, again, this whole proceeding is a farce and a sham, because you can only give an exemption to the act of circumvention.
If it's a farce, what are we doing? What can we do about it? So let's stick to the topic.
Right.
I was just going to say that, after many years of these proceedings, I'd always be concerned with a record in which we were relying on my friend Jonathan Band for doses of reality. Just put it that way. He has a finely honed sense of the bizarre. He's already expressed that this afternoon. But when you look at, let us look at the submissions and the record in terms of the reality, in terms of this issue of censorship. There is no evidence about the issue of censorship in this context. The proponents have an ideological aversion to requesting permission. If you look on page 9, they say literature professors do not need to license the quotations that they read in class. Chemistry professors do not need permission to use a particular compound in class. I'm still working on the copyright implications of that one. Requiring media professors to license clips for use in class would endanger academic freedom and diminish the educational experience for students. For these reasons, licensing cannot constitute